The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
I'm Mo Rocca, and I've got a brand new podcast. It's all about the people who have long fascinated me. The one thing they've got in common? They're all dead. The name of my brand new podcast? Mobituaries. From the 20th century's greatest entertainer.
He was everything. I mean, he could play any instrument. He could dance like a maniac.
To the founding father, who just doesn't seem to get much respect.
This guy did everything wrong. So there's no statue, there's no signature on the Declaration of Independence.
You'll learn new things about people you thought you knew.
Were you aware that the day of your inauguration, Audrey Hepburn died?
No.
You'll learn about people who aren't real.
They did not have room in the writing for the older brother because the Fonz became the older brother.
So join me this premiere season of Mobituaries.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The latest development in the Russia probe.
Judge Amy Berman Jackson hauled the longtime Trump advisor in to explain an Instagram post Monday showing her photo next to what appears to be the crosshairs of a gun.
Later, reporting from Venezuela amid a humanitarian crisis.
People were having to weigh the currency instead of counting it because that's how much you needed for just a normal transaction.
And now, from the Capital One Bank Studios in the CBS News Washington Bureau, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Let's start this weekend with a warning to former Trump campaign advisor Roger Stone from the judge overseeing his case on charges stemming from the Russia probe. Here's CBS News correspondent Paula Reed.
Roger Stone was uncharacteristically silent as he left federal court in Washington after being slapped with a gag order. Judge Amy Berman Jackson hauled the longtime Trump advisor in to explain an Instagram post Monday showing her photo next to what appears to be the crosshairs of a gun and a caption suggesting she is politically biased. Berman is overseeing Stone's prosecution on seven charges filed by special counsel Robert Mueller. On the witness stand, Stone called the post a stupid lapse in judgment. Under questioning from special counsel prosecutors, Stone could not remember who sent him the photo. Jackson shot back, "How hard was it to come up with a photograph that doesn't have crosshairs in the corner?" The judge finally ordered Stone not to comment on his pending trial or risk being sent to jail. "I gave you a second chance, but this is not baseball. There will not be a third chance." Stone is a longtime Republican operative and self-described dirty trickster.
It is better to be infamous than never be famous at all.
And the latest Trump associate charged by Mueller. He has actively courted the media during his case.
As I have always said, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Sources tell CBS News the special counsel is expected to issue its final report in the coming weeks. If the special counsel's office is dissolved, Stone's case will be handled by U.S. attorneys here in Washington who have been working alongside Mueller's team on the case. Paula Reed, CBS News, the White House.
Meanwhile, President Trump has been lashing out against former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe following McCabe's criticism of him to 60 Minutes and other news organizations while promoting his book.
Well, I think Andrew McCabe has made a fool out of himself over the last couple of days, and he really looks to me like sort of a poor man's J. Edgar Hoover. He's a disaster.
That's the president talking to reporters in the Oval Office. White House correspondent Major Garrett has more on the president's reactions on Twitter and what McCabe said about him.
"Wow, so many lies," the president wrote, noting McCabe was fired for lying and branding his story even more deranged. McCabe told 60 Minutes Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein in the chaotic days after the president fired FBI Director James Comey, suggested wearing a wire to record Mr. Trump as part of an FBI investigation into possible obstruction of justice.
Now, he was not joking. He was absolutely serious, and in fact, he brought it up in the next meeting we had.
McCabe also said Rosenstein discussed how the cabinet might use the 25th Amendment to remove Mr. Trump from office.
It was really something that he kind of threw out in a very frenzied, chaotic conversation about where we were and what we needed to do next.
Senator Lindsey Graham, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, vowed to call McCabe and Rosenstein to testify under oath.
Was this an attempted bureaucratic coup? I don't know. I don't know who's telling the truth.
McCabe, referencing a conversation the president had with another FBI official, accused Mr. Trump of discounting U.S. intelligence on North Korea.
The president said he did not believe that the North Koreans had the capability to hit us here with ballistic missiles in the United States. And he did not believe that because President Putin had told him they did not.
Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris weighed in while campaigning in New Hampshire.
The idea that the president of the United States would take the word of the head of Russia over the head of the intelligence community is the height of irresponsibility.
The Justice Department said Rosenstein never authorized a wire recording of the president and that he was in no position to invoke the 25th Amendment. At this point, President Trump has not specifically denied the accusation. He accepted Putin's word over that of U.S. intelligence. Major Garrett, CBS News, the White House.
We heard earlier from Paula Reed about expectations that Mueller's report would be completed and turned into the attorney general soon. Now to correspondent Bill Rakoff, what would happen next?
Steve, one of the attorney general will do is make a presentation to Senate and House judiciary leaders on Capitol Hill of what the overview of the report is. But then there's a big decision that Barr has to make, and some are saying this could be the key decision of his career, and that is how much of this report gets released to the public.
And this isn't the end of the Russia probe either with the completion of Mueller's report, is it?
No, it may be that, you know, there may be more stuff to investigate and that Mueller simply hands it off to other U.S. attorneys, as he had with some other cases going to the Southern District of New York.
What has any ally or opponent of President Trump been saying on Capitol Hill?
Senator Lindsey Graham is one of those who's been saying, look, based on everything I've seen so far and everything that I've heard, I just don't believe there's going to be any collusion against the president himself. There may be against others. And of course, you have seen the indictments along the way of the Manafort's and the Stones on other matters. But there may be some thought that some people around the president might have been involved. Does that include Donald Trump Jr.? We don't know. And we won't know until the report is released. But Democrats, on the other hand, say, they don't know what the report's going to say, but once the report comes out, they will continue their investigations, particularly in the House of Representatives, where Democrats have control of the chamber.
And already in a few days, we're expecting Michael Cohen to testify as well.
Yeah, and that's going to be an embarrassment for the president. He is due on Capitol Hill Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of this coming week, and he is expected to talk about some of the things that have already been made public about hush payments, if you will, to Stormy Daniels and others. But there may be other things that they press him for. Democratic lawmakers will want to try to get the intimate details of things the president might have said, the way he acts behind closed doors, that sort of thing. Republicans, on the other hand, will press Cohen very hard, questioning his credibility, saying, look, you've lied to us before. You're back here again. Why should we believe you now? It will be an interesting week.
And Michael Cohen has now had his date to federal prison changed from March the 6th to May the 6th because of his testimony to Congress and also his recovery from shoulder surgery. CBS News correspondent Bill Rakoff on the Russia probe. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Another story on Friday that generated headlines, the Jupiter, Florida prostitution sting that allegedly caught New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft. His spokesman denies Kraft engaged in any illegal activity. Coming up, what's at stake for the president's second summit with Kim Jong-un?
What the administration says it wants is a firmer commitment from North Korea with regard to denuclearization.
That's next on the Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
The White House is making final preparations for President Trump's second summit with North Korea's Kim Jong-un, and so is our White House correspondent, Stephen Portnoy, who will be in Hanoi covering the event. Stephen, what does the Trump administration want from this second meeting with Kim?
What the administration says it wants is a firmer commitment from North Korea with regard to denuclearization. And in particular, the administration wants the North Koreans to actually sign on to a particular definition of the term denuclearization. So going forward in the wake of last year's Singapore summit, the United States wants a much more clear commitment about how Kim Jong-un sees denuclearization. The U.S. also wants the North Koreans to freeze their missile programs and their weapons of mass destruction programs. And the U.S. also wants a roadmap for future negotiations along these lines. The president has spoken of how warm his relationship is now with Kim Jong-un and how the missile tests have ceased, how the remains of American prisoners of war have been returned, how American captives have been returned, and how the overall rhetoric has cooled.
Are there any indications of what North Korea wants out of this?
No, it's not clear. And what is also interesting is the extent to which the North Koreans have, over the last year since the Singapore summit, at times held the U.S. at bay. In fact, there was a period of time in late 2018 where attempts at talks to continue this process sort of stalled. And Secretary of State Pompeo went to Pyongyang and was essentially stood up by Kim Jong-un. But in recent months, really just in the last 2 months, things seem to have gotten back on track. Direct communication in the form of letters have been transmitted between the president and Kim Jong-un. And the president is hopeful that a lot can be accomplished in Vietnam. But going into this, I'll be honest with you, Steve, we don't really have a great deal of visibility on what's been discussed behind closed doors between the U.S. and the North Koreans and exactly what we can expect to come out of it. So that's why it's going to be very important for all of us to watch these developments as they play out over the next week.
And can you draw any conclusions on why this is being held in Vietnam?
Well, Vietnam in particular as a locale, look, it's relatively close, so Kim Jong-un can make the trip. It is a communist country, so there's a natural and an understandable affinity. Vietnam has also had warm relations over the last decade or two with the United States. You have the fact that President Trump has visited Vietnam over the course of his presidency. In fact, this trip we're going to take to Hanoi is the second time in the last year and 2 or 3 months that President Trump will have been in Hanoi. So there's some comfortability, I think, or level of comfort for the North Koreans, and the president is willing to meet with Kim Jong-un there.
CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy on his reporting from Hanoi covering the second Trump-Kim summit. Safe travels, Stephen.
Thanks, Steve.
Now to the arrest of a Coast Guard lieutenant, Paul Hassan. Federal officials accuse him of being a white supremacist, stockpiling weapons, and keeping a hit list of prominent people. More from Pentagon correspondent David Martin.
Hassan drafted an email saying, "I am dreaming of a way to kill almost every last person on the earth through biological attacks and a bombing and sniper campaign." A search of his basement residence turned up 15 firearms and more than 1,000 rounds of ammunition. Maria Carias is Hassan's neighbor in Silver Spring, Maryland.
"We're all going to be very cautious because they are our neighbors. Like, we would have never imagined that to happen, especially like so close to us."
Hassan, who once served in the Marine Corps, also kept a hit list that reads like a who's who of liberal politics. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, presidential candidates Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, and Cory Booker. Hassan's internet searches included "best place in D.C. to see congresspeople" and "are Supreme Court justices protected?" His list also included well-known news personalities Joe Scarborough, Chris Hayes, Don Lemon, and Chris Cuomo.
"This is scary. This is something that the people who get named we have to deal with, especially with our family."
According to court documents, Hassan read the writings of a Norwegian domestic terrorist named Anders Breivik, who in 2011 went on a rampage killing 77 Norwegians, many of them teenage summer campers. Breivik wrote about using steroids to turn himself into a superhuman one-man army. The search of Hassan's apartment turned up over 30 bottles of human growth hormone.
David Martin reporting. In Chicago, Empire actor Jussie Smollett appeared in court Thursday accused of staging an attack on himself, reporting it to police as a hate crime. More from correspondent Kenneth Craig.
Chicago police released the mugshot of actor Jussie Smollett hours after he turned himself in on charges he filed a false police report.
Actor Jussie Smollett took advantage of the pain and anger of racism
to promote his career.
Police say the Empire star lied when he said two men attacked him last month, shouting racist and homophobic slurs, a claim he described in detail in a Good Morning America interview.
He said, "This MAGA country punches me right in the face."
Police say they are offended and angry at what they call the publicity stunt. They said Smollett first sent himself a racist and homophobic letter, and when that didn't work, he staged the attack. They offered a motive for Smollett's actions.
This stunt was orchestrated by Smollett because he was dissatisfied with his salary.
Police initially investigated the alleged incident as a possible hate crime, but eventually two brothers linked to Smollett told investigators the actor paid them to stage the attack. CBS Chicago station WBBM obtained surveillance video that shows the brothers, Ola and Abel Asendiro, buying a red cap, gloves, and a ski mask the day before Smollett claimed he was assaulted. The brothers are cooperating with police and have not been charged. Smollett's lawyers released a statement saying their client enjoys the presumption of innocence. If convicted, Smollett faces a $25,000 fine and up to 3 years in prison. Kenneth Craig, CBS News.
Meanwhile, the Southern Poverty Law Center says the number of hate groups is at an all-time high.
I'm Gary Nunn. Extremism is on the increase. The number of active groups that the civil rights organization describes as embracing hate has climbed 7% over the past year, the highest level in two decades, reflecting a more divisive debate on immigration and demographic change. Most significant growth over the past 2 years, white supremacists. However, the SPLC report indicates the ranks of the Ku Klux Klan appear to be declining, largely because the group has been unable to attract younger people. This is the fourth consecutive year that the overall numbers have gone up. Gary Nunn, CBS News.
Up next, an exodus from Venezuela amid a deepening humanitarian crisis there.
You have people who go looking for a new life.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Every Sunday, Face the Nation brings you in-depth interviews with the biggest names in Washington.
Kellyanne Conway, Nancy Pelosi, Lindsey Graham, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
You'll never miss an episode with the weekly podcast from CBS News Radio. Tune in to hear moderator Margaret Brennan and the country's top policymakers discuss today's toughest issues.
What is going on? Is this political conspiracy or is this just incompetence?
The Face the Nation podcast. Subscribe today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Along the Colombian border with Venezuela, volunteers are working to break through barriers to deliver food and medicine to Venezuelans. President Nicolas Maduro has so far blocked humanitarian aid and cut off land and sea links to nearby countries. Correspondent Manuel Bojorquez traveled to Venezuela and the Colombian border to see firsthand efforts to get food and medicine into the country. Manuel, what challenges did you see on the ground there?
From watching state-run TV down there, I can tell you this. There are even reports that the food is bad, that it even can cause cancer. That's the information coming from the government right now when it comes to the humanitarian aid that the U.S. has deposited on the borders just outside Venezuela. Of course, you have Juan Guaido, the opposition leader and self-proclaimed interim president, who is telling people, listen, we're going to get it in here. We're going to help you. We're hearing about all the needs that you have, and this is the time to get it in. But it also underscores the fact that at this point, a month into his interim presidency, as he would call it, he does not have control of the military. So that clearly complicates the situation there, makes it more of a continued stalemate at this point.
What is keeping aid from reaching the folks of Venezuela?
Well, it's simply a matter of controlling the borders. You have aid on the other side in Cucuta, for example, where we have witnessed before just scores of Venezuelans who cross the border there. The bridge is a pedestrian bridge, and you have people who go looking for a new life in Colombia. More than 1 million Venezuelans have settled in Colombia over the last few years. But there are also people who go just for the day to look for work, to look for food, to look for medicine. But there is no sense that at this point they can really come back in through that pedestrian bridge with a large amount of humanitarian aid, whether it be medicine or food. The military there has doubled down, saying that they, as you mentioned, will make sure that the borders are enforced, that they have people out there. I asked Juan Guaido while we were there, because he has asked, as you know, for a large humanitarian volunteer force to bring the humanitarian aid in. And we asked, you know, are you pitting possibly those volunteers, these civilians, against the army that has strict orders not to allow anything in? But at this point, he goes back to urging the military to think about their families, about their mothers, urging them to have, in his view, a more humanitarian take on this whole situation and allow that aid in.
I want to talk about reporting from and in Venezuela. How daunting are the logistics of just trying to do your job?
Well, for one, you know, we are really at the mercy of the government when it comes to coming in on a visa that identifies you as a journalist and do it on the up and up. So we were granted that visa this time, as we were back in 2017 when we were there reporting about turmoil in the country as well. I can tell you the difference this time around is in 2017, there was a sense that there was danger. Of course, we were outfitted with helmets and bulletproof vests as a precaution when we went to cover the protests, because there were pretty bloody confrontations between the security forces and the anti-government protesters there. This time around, because there are so many cameras really down there, I mean, the eyes of the world really are in Venezuela right now, we got the sense that the security forces were maybe told not to come down hard on the protesters because they don't want to capture that on camera right now. So ironically, we almost felt a little bit safer. That doesn't mean that there isn't the possibility of skirmishes when these protests happen, and that there aren't people who, according to the opposition, are still being jailed and held as political prisoners. But clearly, Maduro has sensed that there is a lot of international attention on this right now, and after Guaido took the interim presidency, as you know, there were dozens of people killed, according to some estimates on the ground by humanitarian forces. We did not see that this time around.
Yeah, but you have expensive equipment with you. You have access to food and supplies that many people in Venezuela don't have. Is that concerning for your safety?
Yes, absolutely. You know, you go into it like you would any situation where you're in a country where there is rampant crime, mainly driven by poverty at this point, where we interviewed people. We were told by our fixers on the ground, this is a place where you want to go in with a very low profile. So bring a small camera. Don't bring the giant equipment that we traditionally see or use when we're in the United States, for example. You don't want to be flashy. I was told take my watch off and make sure that anything that was in my pockets was in my front pocket where I could keep a better handle on it, because there are those concerns down there. Clearly, we were in a hotel situation where many journalists stay, where there is food. And I can tell you from going around there that the supermarkets in many parts of Caracas also have food. The problem for most people is they simply cannot afford it. When your monthly salary is mere dollars and the cost of food keeps going up and inflation keeps eating up at any savings that you have, that's a situation that people are dealing with on the ground. So as a journalist, you're there to observe clearly, but you cannot just deny the fact that it does pain you to have the ability to have your three meals a day when you're interviewing people who cannot do that. So that's just the reality of being on the ground and reporting down there. People told us they remain hopeful that the situation will be peacefully resolved. There's a saying, you know, la esperanza es lo último que se muere. The hope is the last thing that dies. So even in these really tough times for many people there, they're trying to keep hope alive.
And what about getting even local currency to buy something like lunch?
It's very, very hard to get the new currency, because you have to remember that they got rid of the old one because, you know, at one point, people were having to weigh the currency instead of counting it, because that's how much you needed for just a normal transaction. Our fixer was able to find some cash for us to spend. And at one lunch for four people, what would have been the equivalent of $30 was about 90,000 bolivares, or soberanos as they call them now. So literally, it was stacks upon stacks of the currency just for a lunch. So that gives you an idea of how devalued it is. And for many people, just not practical to use. A lot of people use what's the equivalent of a debit card to get around because it's simply easier. But there are, you know, always outages of these terminals that they use to use them. And people just don't have the money to go around and shop the way we would here in the United States with a debit card.
CBS News correspondent Manuel Bojorquez on the challenges to getting in aid to Venezuela and reporting out. Thank you, Manuel.
Thank you.
Coming up on the weekend roundup, an ISIS bride's fight to return to the U.S.
She herself wants to turn herself in, wants to be held accountable to our laws as a fellow American who's made some horrible mistakes.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
The U.S. says it won't allow a woman born here who fled to Syria to join ISIS to return to the country. More from correspondent Holly Williams in London.
The State Department provided legal reasoning for the decision to bar Hoda Muthanna, saying she is not a U.S. citizen, has no valid U.S. passport, and no right to a passport. But Muthanna's family is adamant she is an American citizen. They've given us a copy of what they claim is her birth certificate, showing she was born in Hackensack, New Jersey. And they say she held a U.S. passport. Muthanna even seems to have tweeted a photograph of it not long after she joined ISIS in Syria, bragging she was going to burn it. Hassan Shibli is the family's lawyer.
She herself wants to turn herself in, wants to be held accountable to our laws as a fellow American who's made some horrible mistakes.
Those mistakes include running away from her family in 2014, traveling to Syria and marrying an ISIS fighter. A post on Muthanna's Twitter account encouraged ISIS supporters in the US to spill the blood of Americans or to rent a big truck and drive all over them. But now living in a refugee camp in eastern Syria, she says she wants a second chance and is not a threat to Americans.
It's part of this. I blame it on being brainwashed, really. I look back at my life and I can't believe I said the things I said and did the things I did.
The family's lawyer told us they will challenge the U.S. government in court, asserting that Hoda Muthanna is an American and has the right to come home, where she would then face the legal consequences of her actions. Holly Williams, CBS News, London.
Domestic violence survivors are being recruited to become Zimbabwe's hidden weapon against poachers. Correspondent Deborah Pato reports.
Just remember your training, use the shadows, use the trees, create depth back in the bush.
Former Australian Special Operations soldier Damien Mander spent years in Iraq as a sniper. Now he's getting his best ranger, Petronella Chigumbura, ready for a solo night patrol.
I'm just looking around and listening. And if there's someone coming inside the park, I can hear him where I'm standing here.
Chigumbura is part of the Akashinga squad, or the Brave Ones, an all-female anti-poaching team that has already arrested 80 poachers in the past year.
Keep those weapons out of the dirt.
Mander told us he once ridiculed the idea of female soldiers.
In our mindset, this was a gamble. I mean, I come from the Ultimate Boys Club. We not only prided ourselves on being the only all-male units in the military, but we ridiculed units that transitioned to accept females.
And he changed his mind when he saw the success of US women on the front lines. The Brave Ones is entirely funded by private donors. The women all come from disadvantaged backgrounds, from desperate poverty to horrific domestic violence. Nyiratso Hoto faced an abusive husband who refused to let her work.
To me, the abusive thing was refusing me to find a job, to look for a job, and to proceed with my education. That's where the fight starts.
Hoto doesn't like talking about it, but she told us he beat her so brutally, often she could barely stand up afterwards. Eventually, she fled from her husband and divorced him.
We thought by putting them through our version of Special Forces selection that we're putting them through hell.
Weapon out of the dirt!
But the reality is that they'd already been through it, and that the distance a person can place between suffering and breaking is what defines the spirit of an individual.
Okay, on the rope.
Now, She is walking on air, carrying a renewed self-confidence and a high-caliber rifle.
What do you think of yourself?
Now I can think that I can do something that is great. No man is going to challenge me again.
One night, the team gets a tip.
There's a raid tonight for Ivory.
A suspected poacher is hiding in the nearby village.
Someone has brought us here, and that's where police have now found him and put him in handcuffs.
He doesn't put up much of a fight, except to demand to know why a woman is guarding him. He's told to keep quiet. The women live for weeks at a time away from their children and families. Petronella Chigumbura, the star sniper, only gets to see her children every 2 months. Mander calls her a leopard on two legs and says her determination runs through the whole squad.
These women came in as individuals. Alone, they were unbreakable. Together, they were unstoppable. So I think women, given the opportunity, will change the face of conservation forever.
Deborah Petta reporting. The man called the grandfather of climate science has died at 87.
Wallace Brokers started to bring the term global warming into common use back in 1975 with an article that predicted trouble from rising carbon dioxide levels. He called it an experiment that could have devastating effects.
In 1990, as a world, we produced 20 billion tons of CO2.
And more since, as he pointed out back in 2013, a colleague says Broker was unique, brilliant, and combative, and he spoke out at a time when few were willing to listen. Steve Kathan, CBS News.
The fashion world is paying tribute to Chanel mastermind Karl Lagerfeld, who died Tuesday at age 85.
With his powdered ponytail, fingerless gloves, and iconic black coat, Karl Lagerfeld was one of the most recognizable designers in the world, even to the unfashionable. The creative force behind Chanel, Lagerfeld spent 5 decades making expensive clothes coveted by celebrities and first ladies, including Melania Trump. He worked his way up the fashion ranks, saving Chanel by making an iconic little jacket cool again. The owner of over 300,000 books and a devoted cat lover, Lagerfeld was one of the few designers left who still sketched his creations by hand.
I like to create images. I'm an image maker. That's in fact what I like best.
His sharp eye was matched only by his sharp tongue. He defended the use of super thin models, deemed sweatpants a sign of defeat, and called the singer Adele a little too fat. For one of his last appearances, he lit up the Champs-Élysées, but his own brilliance never dimmed. Vladimir Dutip, CBS News, New York.
A former Vanderbilt nurse has pleaded not guilty to reckless homicide in a case where her medication error killed an elderly patient. But CBS News correspondent Allison Keyes reports her colleagues are standing behind her.
Prosecutors say Redonda Vaught meant to give an elderly patient a sedative, but instead accidentally gave her a paralytic that killed her after overriding a safety feature that would have blocked the error. But on a crowdfunding page for her legal defense, Vaught wrote that changes should be made to ensure the safety of patients and maintain the safe practice of all nurses. More than $72,000 has been raised online to help pay for her legal defense. Allison Keyes, CBS News.
Coming up, a different kind of yard sale.
Big articulated dump trucks, the excavators, the rollers, we got the pavers, of course.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
What we want to try to do is give the American people the truth.
Jim Bridenstine, administrator of NASA. How close are we to space tourism?
I think we're very close.
Trump cabinet member Linda McMahon.
First time that I met Donald Trump was at a Rolling Stones concert.
Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Samsung pushing the frontier for smartphones. Correspondent Chris Martinez explains.
I can unfold it and instantly see the map on the big screen.
Samsung unveiled a new device called the Galaxy Fold, a phone and tablet in one. The company showed off its new twist on the smartphone at an event in San Francisco.
This is really the future of where our devices are going.
CNET senior reporter Shara Tipkin says this is the first major redesign of the smartphone in years. But the new tech comes at a cost. Prices start at nearly $2,000. The Fold will have similar features as Samsung's latest update to its regular Galaxy phone.
The Galaxy S10.
The S10 has an improved camera and a new ultrasonic fingerprint scanner built right into the screen. There's also a 5G model, which is expected to be up to 20 times faster than today's phones.
People in rural areas or less densely populated areas may not get 5G for a couple years.
The Galaxy S10 goes on sale March 8th. The Fold will be available April 26th. Chris Martinez, CBS News.
The world's biggest auction of heavy construction equipment has been taking place in Florida over the past week, with thousands of big machines headed to new homes in the U.S. and abroad. CBS News correspondent Peter King dug through the bargains and has this report.
If you take a drive down Interstate 4 southwest of Orlando and Walt Disney World, you'll see an amazing sight. Thousands of construction vehicles waiting for new homes.
The big articulated dump trucks that haul the dirt from place to place, the excavators that load that dirt, the rollers and the like that smooth out the road so we can pave them. We got the pavers, of course, and then you've got all the cranes if you need to lift those heavy objects into place.
That's Kieran Holm, Senior Vice President of Ritchie Brothers, which has been holding its annual heavy equipment auction here for nearly two decades. There were nearly 14,000 vehicles and pieces of equipment on 220 acres when the auction began last Monday.
This is the showpiece of the heavy equipment world.
Some perspective from Ritchie Brothers U.S. Operations VP Kevin Kobus.
If you lined all the equipment up at this auction from end to end, you could go from our yard to Cinderella's Castle and back in one continuous line. It would be a 52-mile round trip. If you took just all the bulldozers and lined them up side by side, you'd have a blade that was almost a mile wide.
Intrusion down here in the sun, and down here, 100,000 to go again, Internet.
The auction itself is in a huge auditorium. Vehicles are paraded like models on a runway, but behind the stage.
When it starts on one side of the ramp, it's got its original owner. When it finishes on the other side, it's got a new owner every single time.
This Super Bowl of auctions brings in some 10,000 bidders from all 50 states and about 50 foreign countries. Kieran Holmes says they're always ready.
We've got to have at our front counter when we're doing registration people who can assist registrants and attendees in, of course, English, but also French and Spanish and Farsi and as many languages as we can possibly find within our staff population, which is actually quite broad.
There are bargains to be had. Again, Kevin Kobus.
A consumer could expect to save, 50 to 60% off of new price.
Yeah.
But we're very comparable with the used market. And sometimes we've seen our pricing exceed the used market.
Even with those kinds of savings, Ritchie Brothers says last year's auction brought in about $278 million. Like all auctions, there are some big ticket items.
We saw a drill rig unit for gas and oil to use in the oil industry for $2.5 million.
And Kieran Holmes says there's another reason why the world comes here.
The U.S. equipment has been maintained correctly. It's been operated correctly. Any outstanding issues have been dealt with typically. And so it has a reputation on the global scale of being the best equipment from a use standpoint that you can find.
Bidders include construction companies and heavy equipment dealers like Trip Pittman of Mobile, Alabama.
It establishes the market. This is the market for used equipment, in the world, but certainly in the country. If you're in the business, you need to be here and keep up with what's going on here. Just as you know about, the New York Stock Exchange and the world markets, the NASDAQ, their prices on stocks. This is about iron, different types of heavy equipment.
What do you want to take home with you this week? How much?
Well, obviously, it's you've got to make as good a buy as you can. I'm in the resale business and the rental business. But, we do buy equipment of brands that we sell and also equipment that we rent. So, you can still find good buys at this sale, though you have to work hard to do it because there's a lot of buyers here.
Just a couple of things on your shopping list.
Wheel loaders, looking for wheel loaders, compaction equipment, looking for bulldozers, articulated trucks, looking a little bit of everything.
Just about everyone we spoke with says the huge turnout is a good indicator, not just of the market, but the health of the economy and construction business in general. As for checking out the goods, you can't take these machines out for a spin, but you can put them through the paces, like I did with a Caterpillar excavator, moving the big bucket up and
back down. There it goes. There
you go. They even let me roll it back and forth.
But we can go ahead and pull straight back again on that. And then grab both of these at the same time.
Yeah.
And just slowly push forward.
Ah, there we go. Stop.
So here's the disclaimer. As a kid, I collected Dinky, Corgi, Matchbox, and Tonka toys and loved the construction machines. I still do. Apparently, I'm not alone. Kevin Kovas says the huge display often causes traffic to slow down on Interstate 4.
People would be going from Legoland to Disney World and they'd see all this equipment. And, you know, you're just kind of awestruck as you go by.
Some people actually stop here, and as long as they follow the safety rules, they can look around. I think it's pretty safe to say that when you hang around these big machines, there's a little kid in just about all of us. I'm Peter King, CBS News, in Davenport, Florida.
Finally this weekend, one family's experience in California's deadly wildfires has a happy ending.
Gabriel Baeos says his family never lost hope that they would be reunited with their dog Kingston, who jumped out of their truck as they fled the deadly fires in the Northern California town of Paradise. And their faith paid off. They were reunited with the 12-year-old Akita 101 days after he disappeared. Vallejo says the reunion nearly brought him to tears, and that's not just because Kingston smelled like skunk. The family believes he survived by eating skunks because he hunted them before the fire. Pam Coulter, CBS News.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Jake Rosen is the intern. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.